May I please speak up?
Certainly.
And are you able to hear me?
You may need to speak up.
You will need to.
Please let me know. I'll be happy to try to speak as loud as I can.
Louder than that, we can't hear you.
Is that any better for you?
A little bit.
Okay.
Maybe talk closer to the microphone.
Okay. This appeal presents comprehensive challenges to the entire statutory scheme and has raised issues with each stage of the proceedings under the SVP Act. The first issue that I would like to talk about is the burden of proof. Incidentally, the last time this court heard an SVP case, it was about the burden of proof. And in 2008, Van Orden did decide that clear and convincing was an appropriate burden of proof in SVP cases. But it did so citing two specific reasons. One, the assumption that the proceedings were civil, and two, the assumption that a continuing opportunity for review would minimize the risk of erroneous commitments. We know that neither of those two things are true. We know the law is punitive, and in fact, the federal court in Schaefer tells us that it's punitive, that the law results in lifetime confinement and unconstitutional punishment of men who have been committed in violation of the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause. We also know that there is no unconditional release, and that there are no continuing review opportunities in the event conditional release is ever granted.
Now, the federal court said it was unconstitutional as applied.
Yes, sir, it did. It found that the act was constitutional on its face because it said it was bound to follow the holdings of this court finding the law civil and constitutional. This court can find that the law is unconstitutional on its face and as applied, and if it adopts the findings of Schaefer, I think it will come to the same conclusions, and it will require substantial changes to be made to the administration of the law and how it operates in order to bring the program into constitutional compliance. The proceedings have gradually assimilated into criminal prosecutions, just like juvenile proceedings did. And we know from In re Winship that when the proceedings do, they start out as civil and they may accomplish a civil purpose. When there is such a restraint on an individual's liberty, the only appropriate burden of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt. That is the only standard that balances Mr. Kirk's stake of indefinite deprivation of his liberty with the state's interest. We know that men are not released once they have been civilly committed. We know that the plain language of the act doesn't allow discharge. The 2006 amendments took out the word discharge, so discharge from confinement, which we have called unconditional release, and it mandates that an individual who has been committed now may only ever be conditionally released. But conditional release does not restore his liberty or allow him to regain his freedom. Because under subsection 505, if conditionally released, he is always subject to the conditions of that statute. There are some other measures in the release provisions which weren't before this court in Van Orden that we also need to look at and take into consideration. If an individual is conditionally released, their conditional release can be revoked based on a preponderance finding by the court that they are no longer suitable for conditional release. And so that means an individual has to demonstrate he no longer meets the criteria for commitment to be conditionally released. So either the judicially determined mental abnormality has abated, or his risk has fallen below the statutory threshold for civil commitment. But to return him to secure confinement as a sexually violent predator, the burden on the state is only to show for some reason he is unsuitable for conditional release, and that's by a preponderance. Then he's returned to secure confinement, where once again he has to prove he no longer has a mental abnormality or no longer has risk if he's ever to be conditionally released again. The problem is, we know that the Department of Mental Health has never authorized anyone to seek conditional release. They have no plans in place for community placement options, which are required. And there are no individuals who have ever been liberated from the custody of the Department of Mental Health, even those who have been adjudicated to no longer suffer from a mental abnormality or no longer have that threshold of risk. and have been conditionally released. So the government has no interest in confining individuals who don't meet the criteria, who are not mentally ill or not dangerous. And Mr. Kirk should not be asked to share equally with the state in this case. The burden should be on the state to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt, just like any other type of proceeding where an individual is subject to such a loss of liberty and where it will be for the rest of his lifetime. The next issue I would like to talk about, if the court doesn't have any questions about the burden of proof, is Instruction 7 and another provision of the statute, subsection 492. That portion of the statute requires a jury to be instructed that if an individual meets criteria for civil commitment, they will be committed to the custody of the Department of Mental Health for care, control, and treatment. Mr. Kirk objected to this instruction on the basis that that statute is unconstitutional. And it's unconstitutional for several reasons. The consequence of the verdict is not an issue for the jury in an SVP case. As the state pointed out in their brief, where an individual like Mr. Kirk has pled guilty to an underlying sexually violent offense, the only two issues before the jury are, one, does he have a mental abnormality, and two, that makes him more likely than not to commit predatory acts of sexual violence if not confined. The consequence of the verdict is mandatory, and statute mandates that the judge must commit an individual who meets those criteria to the Department of Mental Health. That is not an issue that the jury decides. However, this statute requires an instruction to the jury focusing their attention on the very thing that they should ignore, the consequence of their verdict. It diverts their attention from the two issues that they are to decide. It invites them to consider the consequence and to render a verdict that's for treatment. And in SVP cases, we frequently hear about treatment during the evidence. And in Mr. Kirk's case, we did hear about a treatment program. And that was the Missouri Sex Offender Program he participated in while he was in the Department of Corrections. But treatment under the SVP Act is nothing like MOSA. That program was a year long, and the jury heard that if Mr. Kirk successfully completed that, he would be entitled to parole. But in SVP cases, we don't tell the jury anything about care, control, and treatment and what that would look like should the jury render a verdict committing him. And in fact, in Mr. Kirk's case, we asked the trial court to allow us to present that testimony and that evidence, and that request was denied. In addition to improperly diverting the jury's attention and inviting them to consider the consequence, which minimized the responsibility to decide the issues,
you know, in criminal cases, don't we tell them the person's going to go to prison, and often they say what the sentence should be? I'm unclear why it's not okay here, but it is there.
Well, in Shannon versus the United States, it specifically tells us that when a jury doesn't serve a sentencing function, they should be instructed to disregard, or they should not be invited to give regard to the punishment. The jury has no sentencing function in this case where it's deciding the consequence. We wouldn't give a jury information about the death penalty in the first phase of a capital trial. We would reserve that for the second phase. We don't inform them, for example, that the governor could pardon them if they were to give someone the death penalty, or that someone could get clemency, or somehow their conviction could be overturned, because we want them to focus on the issues, and those are, did this individual commit this crime based on these elements that are set out in the verdict director? So it should be no different here. Where the jury has no role in that, we shouldn't give them this abstract statement of law that they are not invited to make a finding about. We should ask them only to find the two issues that we know are theirs in a jury trial, and that's whether or not Mr. Kirk had a mental abnormality and whether his risk met the statutory threshold. In this case, there is no evidence to support giving this instruction, which is another reason why it was an error. In voir dire, the state told the jury there are only two issues for you to decide, and those are if he meets the criteria. You don't get to decide what happens if he meets criteria or not. But in closing, the state got to stand up and say, this is instruction 7, and it tells you if you find he's an SVP, he'll be committed to DMH for control, care, and treatment. He needs care, control, and treatment. That argument would not be available to the government but for this instruction, particularly in a case like Mr. Kirk's where there was no evidence of care, control, and treatment. The argument was not Mr. Kirk meets the criteria, return a verdict that finds he has a mental abnormality and finds he has risk. The request was he needs care, control, and treatment, and this instruction 7 tells you he can get that just that he's an SVP. The next issue I'd like to discuss is change of venue, if there are no further questions about the last instruction. Mr. Kirk filed a motion for a change of venue under Rule 5103 as a matter of right, and it's reversible error to deny a change of judge where he's entitled to it as a matter of right. In this case, the state said at the trial level Mr. Kirk didn't have rights to a change of venue and that he wasn't entitled to a change of venue under any of the rules. And Mr. Kirk's motion cited civil rules, criminal rules, and rules that specifically apply to the probate division. Mr. Kirk's motion was noticed up. There was a special hearing the second time we appeared before the trial judge just to take up the change of venue motion. There was also a request for continuance at the same time, and the court denied the request for a continuance specifically because there was another courtroom available in an adjacent county where we could have the trial during the scheduled time. But the court agreed with the state and overruled Mr. Kirk's request for a change of venue. And so, if for no other reason presented in this appeal, because we were entitled to a change of venue as a matter of right.
And so opposing counsel says all those continuances and the many times you had an opportunity to bring up the change of venue request and failed to do so constituted a waiver. Can you explain further why you don't believe it was a waiver?
Well, the state didn't raise that argument at the trial level, and that was a new argument that they raised on appeal, and I think in response to my brief. And we do have a couple of opinions from this court that said even the respondent in an appeal, when they raised an instructional or raised a timing issue like that, this court wouldn't consider it because it, that argument.
Well, but the trial court denied the venue change. You're trying to show why it was wrong, so they can raise other reasons why the trial judge ruled correctly.
Sure. So we didn't waive the issue. We did take it up the second time that we ever had any contact with Judge Hopkins, who was our presiding trial judge. We had a special hearing just for that. There were subsequent continuances granted, and the state's brief cites that a continuance was granted about a month later, and that was to hold an evidentiary hearing in response to their motion to exclude some evidence.
I'm afraid I've taken you past your time, so you'll have to answer on rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I want to begin with the burden of proof in these cases. This court in 2008 has explained that the burden of proof in these cases is properly delegated to the legislature. The legislature has chosen to have clear and convincing evidence. This court's opinions demonstrate that the Due Process Clause does not require beyond a reasonable doubt, and nothing has truly changed that would require a re-examination of that case. Mr. Kirk relies very heavily on the Schaefer case, but there are three primary reasons why Schaefer does not assist Mr. Kirk's case in this court. First, the Schaefer case is not final. Second, the Schaefer case is not about Mr. Kirk. And third, the Schaefer case is not about commitment trials. In Schaefer, the case is divided into a liability and a remedies phase. It is true that the liability phase has concluded. The remedies portion is ongoing. The state is in active settlement discussions with representatives for the committed men, as well as the American Civil Liberties Union and other interested parties. The fact that the case is not final is important for another reason, beyond the general rule that we can't rely on a non-final, non-completed opinion. And that is that that opinion is a snapshot in time from September 11, 2014, as modified in December. It does not reflect any of the changes that have occurred in the last 2 years.
And what are those changes?
Well, I cite many of the many cases in my brief at the circuit court level, where, in fact, petitions for conditional release are pending, including some with director's approval. That question is an illustration of the fact that the record in this court is not complete. This court does not have an accurate picture of the facts because Schaefer itself is not complete. And the probate court certainly did not have an accurate picture of the facts when it was provided a copy of that lengthy opinion the morning of trial with a hand-delivered memorandum. And so it would be inappropriate for this court to reverse the probate court based on facts that were never presented to the probate court and law that was delivered to the probate court moments before the trial was scheduled to begin. The case
is it right in that case? I mean, what about the rationale of that decision? Can you address its application here?
The rationale of the Schaefer decision?
Yes.
The Schaefer court found that as applied to the men who are currently committed, the release procedures are not being properly carried out. Of course, that says nothing about Mr. Kirk's case because the release procedures have not yet been applied to him, or at least were not at the time of the trial. And so what Mr. Kirk is asking this court to do is first assume that the district court for the Eastern District of Missouri properly found that the release procedures are not being carried out, and then on that inference stack another inference that the state will continue to not carry out the release procedures properly as applied to Mr. Kirk. That's the second reason why the Schaefer case is of no use to Mr. Kirk here. It's not about Mr. Kirk. And of course, Mr. Kirk has many opportunities in the future, if he feels that the release procedures are not being properly applied to him, to raise that claim. He could come to the state courts of Missouri and say, in a habeas action, the current conditions of my confinement are illegal. I need to be released. He could file a petition for declaratory judgment in circuit court and say that the state of Missouri is not carrying the release procedures out. He could, in fact, return to federal court, just like the currently committed men have done, and argue that the release procedures are not being carried out. And so what Mr. Kirk is really doing here is asking this court to make those two assumptions, that the district court is correct and that the law will be unconstitutionally applied to Mr. Kirk in the future, and that's assumptions that are just not supported by the record in this case. And finally, that Schaefer case is not about commitment. It's only a challenge to the release procedures. And this is a case about the commitment procedures. So it's inappropriate to rely on this non-final case, which is not actually about Mr. Kirk and which doesn't deal with the subject matter before this court today. In the Van Orden case that this court decided in 2008, it talks about what due process requires, a balancing of the risk between the litigants. The state's interest in these cases are, yes, to protect the public from sexually violent predators, but the state also has an interest, as this court has recognized, in providing treatment to these mentally ill people.
Has the statute changed since the Van Orden case?
Not since the Van Orden case was decided. The Van Orden decision was issued in 2008. The statute was amended in 2006. And so there has not been a change since the Van Orden case.
But it dealt with the earlier version of the statute.
The challenge in the Van Orden case was to an earlier version, but of course this court said that issue is not ripe for consideration because none of the individuals have demonstrated that they're entitled to conditional or unconditional release. And when the court did the analysis of the Van Orden in the Van Orden case, I don't think that the court was really looking at the prior text of the statute. But to the extent, even if it was, there's not been a substantial enough change to the language of the statute that would necessitate a different result. What was discussed in the Van Orden and in the Norton case from before that is the idea that, unlike a criminal trial, the Sexually Violent Predator Act contains multiple rounds of judicial review for release from confinement. So unlike a criminal case, where an individual is sentenced There's no judicial resource to shorten the sentence. Certainly there's probation, there's parole, and there can be challenges to the conviction. But in this case, an individual's confinement can be limited by the fact that they get better. And courts have routine opportunities once a year to analyze that. They have additional opportunities in that at any time a committed man can file a petition for release. So these cases are different than criminal cases, and that additional process for release is part of why clear and convincing evidence is the appropriate burden at this stage.
Can a sexually violent predator ever be unconditionally released?
No court has had to answer that. No Missouri court has had to answer that question. Under the current version of the statute, conditional release is allowed, but of course, as I discussed in my brief and as the federal district court said, this court presumes that statutes are constitutional. The Sexually Violent Predator Act allows for a court, even on its own motion, without notice from either party, to modify the conditions at any time. So there's not, the word dismissal is no longer in the statute after the amendments, but certainly a court, if an individual has demonstrated he is safe to be at large, can remove the reporting condition. A court could remove any of the conditions, including all of them.
So is that a roundabout way of saying there is no unconditional release under the statute?
I don't think that is a roundabout way of saying it. I agree that there's no longer the word dismissal from secure confinement, which is what was in the statute before. Discharge, I'm sorry, that's right. There is conditional release, but I think it's consistent with the statutory scheme to allow a trial court who's closest to the individual and has an opportunity to hear evidence about how they're performing on conditional release to lessen and modify the conditions to the point where they remove all of the conditions of release.
So in effect, it would be an unconditional release.
It could be if an individual ever achieved a level of safety where that were appropriate.
Has that ever occurred? Do we know?
No. No individual has ever made it to that level of safety.
Was that what the federal district court addressed?
Well, yes. But the federal district court talked about that in the context of 2014. Of course, as I point out in my brief, two individuals were released into the community after the 2014 decision, and both of those individuals were revoked for their poor performance in the community, engaging in risky behaviors.
So, what about this issue of change of venue? I mean, it's a timely filed application of change in judge and change in venue. Why didn't that have to be sustained?
Well, first, there's the waiver that I discussed in my brief under Chambers. In this case, the motion for change of venue languished in the court file for 22 months. In Chambers, it was a mere 8 months, which is very short in comparison. Here, we have that additional delay. We have alternative requests for relief. But even if the court doesn't want to address the waiver issue, Mr. Kirk was not entitled to a change of venue under the Sexually Violent Predator Act. The legislature, when it established these cases, indicated that the petition has to be filed in the probate division, not in the civil division, not in a criminal division, but in the probate division. And, of course, cases filed in the probate division are governed by the probate rules. At no point under Rule 4401 did the probate court indicate that it was going to apply the civil rules for change of judge or change of venue.
You're not saying you couldn't change a judge for cause. You're saying you don't believe the automatic change of judge rules apply? Or
that's correct. Of course, if there was any conflict under Rule 4 or the judicial canons, that would be an appropriate time for a change of judge, just like in any other case. But Rule 4401 requires there to be notice given if a probate court is going to apply civil rules, and of course that never happened in this case. And so it truly was improper, or would have been improper, for a probate court to grant the change of venue. And I think
if the probate courts in these types of cases just started out as a matter of course because they're litigated almost always to trial, almost always to jury, and the probate entered that just as a standard order in its own, so the rules of civil procedure apply, would you agree then that a timely application for change of venue and judge would both have to be sustained?
Yes, if there was that standing order, and if there was no waiver issue like there was in the Chambers case. And under the facts of this case, there was a waiver. I mean, the change of venue was only brought back to the attention of the trial court based on events in Pettis County, where an individual was reported in the news to have kidnapped a woman and kept her in a box under his bed. That is the point at which the change of venue was renewed. It was never renewed in the months before that event was reported in the news media, or immediately after it was filed. And the trial court took additional remedies to fix that problem with that pretrial publicity. The court, in this case, ordered 100 jurors so that voir dire could weed out any of those individuals. And, of course, no one had indicated that they were swayed by any untoward media reports. I do want to briefly talk about, before my time expires, a challenge to 632-492. That's the jury instruction. There was not a pretrial motion to challenge the constitutionality of that statute. And as the court heard in the last argument, and as I point out in the brief, constitutional challenges to statutes must be raised at the earliest opportunity. There were certainly many, many opportunities to raise a constitutional challenge to that statute before the jury instruction conference during the trial. Even if the court doesn't want to enforce that rule and wants to look at the merits, which I think would be unfair given that the probate court didn't really have an opportunity to fully consider this kind of claim, there's no due process or equal protection violation in giving that statute. In civil cases, a civil commitment trial, MAIC v. 3618, which is the verdict director, the question asked for the jury is, should the individual be detained for treatment? MAIC v. 31.14, I'm sorry, that is the verdict director, presents two questions. Should the individual be, your verdict should be that the individual should be detained for treatment with the director of the Department of Mental Health if he's mentally ill and a danger to himself or others. So we certainly don't treat sexually violent predators in a substantially different way from those instructions. And in a criminal case, MAICR 30602A, there's an optional paragraph that the defendant can give that says, if your verdict is that the individual was in GRI at the time of the offense, then he will be committed to the custody of the director of the Department of Mental Health for custody and care. So sexually violent predator cases with this instruction are not that different, not substantially different, from what we do in a civil case or what we could do in a criminal case. So there's really no due process or equal protection violation if the court wants to reach the merits. But as I address in the brief, the court, it's not appropriate to reach the merits of that claim because this issue has not been preserved in this case. It was not raised to the probate court at the earliest opportunity to give the probate court a fair and reasonable chance to consider the claim. I see that my time has expired. Are there other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have to look at the commitment phase when considering the SVP Act. There is one SVP Act. There is not a Commitment Act and a Release Act. It is one body of law. And for constitutional purposes, if the intent or the effect of a law is punitive, it's considered criminal proceedings. And the way to know if the effect of the law is punitive is to look at commitment, what happens there, and if anyone can ever be released. Van Orden did not raise challenges to the entire statutory scheme. It only raised a challenge to the specific subsection setting forth the burden of proof. And so the entire statutory scheme was not before this court, and it was not asked to consider the release provisions in context of what burden of proof was required for a commitment trial. Modification of the terms of conditional release is not the elimination of terms. It means only some conditions can be removed or modified, but there's no statutory provision allowing the court to eliminate all of the conditions particularly the conditions that the statute specifically enumerates as being required of any individual who is on conditional release.
But I think opposing counsel's argument, as you know, is that it's premature to address that because at this point your client is not claiming he would be entitled to unconditional release. And the reason you're saying it's unconstitutional or should be treated like a criminal case is because of the release provisions, not because of the commitment provisions. And so it should await that point.
Well, the commitment provisions are inadequate given that there is no unconditional release and that there is never any release from that. In Van Orden, this court did say in a footnote that it wasn't asked to consider if the statute could be considered civil, where the purpose or effect meant that an individual could never obtain unconditional release. And that's the issue that's before this court. If the end result is unconstitutional, that means we have to care about the process leading there, and that the process leading there has to minimize erroneous commitments and has to protect the individual. There is a significant difference in this case and in Chambers concerning the motion for a change of venue. In Chambers, there were multiple hearings before the trial court, at which point in time the attorney in that case made affirmative representations there were no motions and affirmatively told the court and opposing counsel that there was nothing else to take up and they wished to proceed to trial. Then on Sunday evening, when they were
What about the fact that there was no order entered in this case saying that the rules of civil procedure apply?
These are inherently adversarial procedures.
But if you want it declared an adversary proceeding, doesn't that require an order from the court?
I don't think we need an order from the court because it's an inherently adversarial proceeding, as this court already announced in Salcido, which had been overruled on some other grounds. But these are adversarial proceedings by their nature. This also isn't a probate case. Yes, the cause gets filed in the probate division, but this isn't a law brought pursuant to any provision of the probate code. It's brought pursuant to a different provision of the statute. It's not governed by any probate rules in any other context. And this court and the other courts of appeals routinely apply the rules of civil procedure without any order in place directing that they be applied. The SVP Act doesn't make any provisions for appeals, but we automatically apply the civil rules about appeals. It doesn't make provisions for lots of things, but we have to be entitled to a change of judge and a change of venue in these cases. Otherwise, that consigns Mr. Kirk to judgment and fate at the hands of either a judge that is biased or perhaps a county where we're going to draw jurors who are biased against him.
Isn't there a special rule for change of judge in the probate code as well, right?
There is. Mm-hmm. And I think in this particular case, it's significant that we filed a joint request for a change of judge and change of venue, and the change of judge was granted. And so if there is some type of order or ruling required from our probate court that says these rules apply, by granting our request for a change of judge under the civil rules, at least implicitly, then
the first judge who was assigned thought he was obligated to, or she was obligated to, sign the order. Because the original judge didn't apply the special probate statute regarding change of judge, because it doesn't look like you made the allegations necessary to get that sustained.
No, we requested a change of judge as a matter of right, and it was granted immediately that same day. So the law of the case would say this court did not believe it needed to enter a special order to apply these rules, that they inherently applied and that Mr. Kirk had an interest in doing that. I think he also has a due process and equal protection interest in a change of venue, in a change of judge, and we should give these rules their most encompassing effect to effectuate their intent and purpose, not to exclude someone like Mr. Kirk from having the benefit of that.
Your time is up. Thank you. Case will be submitted.